Yevgeny Prigozhin, restaurateur to Vladimir Putin, co-founder of the infamous Wagner Group,
who a couple of years ago led a mutiny which was the closest Vladimir Putin has ever come to being toppled from power.
He's one of Russia's richest and most powerful oligarchs.
He knows what people want.
Prigozhin brings this entrepreneurial streak to violence.
The man the Kremlin calls on to do its dirty work.
He is moving into a space that really only Putin should be in.
The government depends on Wagner for its survival.
At the moment of the peak, he's going to fly too close to the sun.
The world watched as the Wagner Group turned on Russia's military. Yevgeny Prigozhin was enraged by what he says were Russian strikes on his troops in Ukraine.
This is the moment where you go, civil war.
Putin's the ultimate apostle of payback, so I would be surprised if Prigozhin escapes further retribution for this.
If you cross Putin, the likelihood is you're going to die.
I've never been a chef. I used to be a restaurateur, and quite successful. I can't cook myself. They should have just called me Putin's butcher, and everything would have been fine. Well, welcome to The Rest is Classified. I'm David McCloskey.
And I'm Gordon Carrera.
And those are the words of Yevgeny Prigozhin, restaurateur, not a cook, restaurateur to Vladimir Putin, co-founder, I think we'd say, of the infamous Wagner Group.
Yeah.
Private mercenary army used by the Kremlin, soon to be friend of the pod.
Not sure about
after
that.
After we complete our six-part investigation, our series that we're starting, this deep dive into this murky world that blends the security services, the Russian security services, private armies, the Russian state, organized crime, and at its center, a man who used to run a hot dog stand in St. Petersburg.
When you read that opening quote, I was thinking some people might have thought they got the rest is food and we're just going to spend.
There will be a culinary element to this.
There will be a culinary element. How to run a restaurant, you know, how to develop a good menu. We're going to be looking at some of those things, aren't we?
Yes.
As we also look at sledgehammers, you know, murder and mayhem and coups. Yes. So it's going to be a kind of slightly crazy mix of a series. But what I think is significant about Yevgeny Prigozhin, who, you know, a couple of years ago led a mutiny effectively in Russia, which was the closest Vladimir Putin has ever come to being toppled from power. You know, Putin has been there for more than a quarter of a century. This was the one moment when people thought on one day it might be over. He might be overthrown. And it was due to this one guy who has started off selling hot dogs in St. Petersburg 25, 30 years ago and knew Putin all the way from back then. So it kind of tells you quite a lot about Putin and power in Russia, I think.
It shows the extent to which I think Russian power feels very medieval.
Yeah.
It feels like a medieval court in a lot of ways. I mean, here's this kind of spurned courtier, staffer to Putin, yeah, who wants to or perhaps believes he's a bigger man in the system than he really is, and who is going to come face to face with sort of the realities of how Putin manages,
yeah,
the people around him in this kind of hub and spoke model of sort of Russian autocracy, as we'll see. And, you know, I think it also feels a lot like a criminal enterprise.
A gangland.
You know,
yeah,
this sort
syndicate.
Of, yeah. This is sort of a mafia, a spat between the big boss, right, the Don Putin, and one of his kind of henchmen. We have a tendency, I think, in the States or in the West and in the UK to view other states through the lens of their bureaucracies. And we think, okay, you've got your security services and you've got your military and there's sort of an official, you know, system. And as we'll see, Prigozhin, he's very entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
Isn't he? I mean, he's a restaurateur. He's an entrepreneur of food. The seams of these power structures are where Prigozhin is going to really excel. And he's a violent man.
Yeah.
And very entrepreneurial about his violence.
Yeah.
In the creation of the Wagner Group. And this is also a globetrotting story,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. We're going to go right around the world. We're going to go from kind of Leningrad, St. Petersburg in the kind of Cold War days across Africa, Middle East, Syria, place you know well, and then, of course, back to Moscow and with a bit of time in Ukraine. So it's going to kind of encompass a story which really actually has an impact on a huge number of countries. You know, it's not just a story about Russia. It's a story about Africa. It's a story about the Middle East. It's a story about Ukraine. It's a story about Europe as well, I think.
That's right. And we will journey to some of the, actually the worst places in the world.
Yeah, you know, the darkest places.
The wilds of Mali and St. Yeah. Petersburg during sort of the Soviet collapse. And I guess maybe it makes sense, Gordon, to start with some places that will maybe even worse.
Yeah.
Which is Yevgeny Prigozhin's early life.
Yeah. So Yevgeny Prigozhin, born in Leningrad in the Soviet Union, which is, of course, now called St. Petersburg, 1961, interestingly enough, a kind of middle-class Soviet intelligentsia family, not a kind of poor working-class family. His mother, Violetta, works at a hospital. His father, Victor, who dies early, is the nephew of a famous engineer. He's growing up in a slightly dull, stifling world then of the Soviet Union in the late 60s and the 70s under Brezhnev. He's known as Zhenya. Young Prigozhin goes to a good school. He goes to a boarding school, which specializes in sports, which he's into. It trains Olympians. He's into cross-country skiing. It's the classic story, which is if he hadn't had an injury, he would have been an Olympic skier. Now, I don't know if that's true. But, you know, he's not handsome, but he's got a swagger. Now, here's the thing, though. Pretty good start in life. But he leaves school at 16 in 1977, age 16, and he gets mixed up with the wrong crowd.
He drops out of school?
He leaves school, yeah. And maybe it's because the sports thing isn't happening for him. He's clearly clever. He's clearly ambitious. But he's not really suited or into those kind of middle-class professional jobs there might have been. And for all the talk of, you know, equality in the Soviet Union, it's quite a stratified society at that point. He doesn't want to kind of move down the social class. He's a bit of a misfit, doesn't fit in. He can see people around him leading a fancier life. He's ambitious, he's hot-headed, he's a bit cruel, does a brief stint as a PE, a physical education trainer. So you could have got your workout from Evgeny, but he quickly gets into crime as a teenager. And this is the key moment. And it starts with petty crime. He's hanging around with low-level criminals or on the make, gets arrested for petty theft aged 18 in 1979, 2.5 year suspended sentence. He's sent to work in Novgorod, 100 miles from St. Petersburg, in a chemicals factory, but he doesn't learn his lesson. Should have learned his lesson, you know, life of crime.
At the chemicals factory.
Yeah. At the chemicals factory. But instead goes back to St. Petersburg after that, and this is where he gets deeper into the world of crime.
Do we know why he got into crime? Obviously, crime doesn't pay.
It doesn't pay. Kids don't do it.
Yeah, don't do it.
It's, again, I think it's ambition, greed, not having a place, and a desire. I guess you could see it from the earliest days. A desire for things that he feels he should have, others have, and he doesn't have. He's going to want to take those things. He's going to be ambitious to take them. And I think you can see that when he starts hanging out in this, you know, as an 18-year-old, he hangs out with Alexei Lesha Bushman, who's a few years older and runs a small gang of a handful of thieves. I think of kind of a Dickensian world of, you know,
of street urchins.
Of street urchins here, but in St. Petersburg. And Prigozhin is going to help to pick the targets for their activity, sometimes people he knows. February 1980, you break into an apartment, steal a vase, a candy bowl, a napkin holder, and some glasses with a value of 177 rubles. It's not kind of big crime. Next month, they steal a leather steering wheel cover, I mean, and a set of ballpoint pens, a tape recorder, a denim jacket, and a woman's handbag. I mean, it's kind of...
At this point, this is all very juvenile.
This is pretty juvenile. But they swindle a man out of 250 rubles over some jeans. They go out drinking champagne to celebrate and brandy at a restaurant. And at that restaurant, about midnight, they see a young woman with a fancy coat leaving the restaurant. And this coat speaks of money. So Prigozhin says, let's rob her. They follow her by taxi, then on foot, and in a dark street, one of them asks her for a cigarette. Then Prigozhin grabs her by the neck and he starts to choke her. Another man pulls a knife. She screams. Prigozhin, to try and stop her, squeeze harder on her neck until she passes out. They drag her down an alley. One person takes her boots. Prigozhin pulls off her earrings. But her screams have already kind of summoned the police, who are nearby. So these gang of thieves run. One of them doesn't make it. Prigozhin does. But the police will eventually track them all down and come knocking. So now he's in big trouble. They're going to find the other stolen goods. There's robbery with violence and he's broken his probation. But I think you could see in that story, this is a guy who's cruel and violent. You know, you get a sense
he's selected the target. He uses physical violence on her already at a young age.
At a young age, as a kind of 18-year-old. Yeah. So he's going to get sentenced to 13 years in a penal colony. Fortunately, I've never been to a Soviet gulag, as the labor camps are called. There's still time. But they are, I hear, famously brutal places. You know, maybe not quite as dark as in Stalin's day.
It's where Goalhanger rehabilitates its hosts. So yeah, there's still time.
There's still time. But this is Borovskoy Mir, the thieves' world inside these gulags, these prison camps. Of course, there's violence, prisoners in these huge barracks. And the barracks are run by the prisoners rather than by the guards and the officials, and especially hardened criminal gangs. And so Prigozhin's going to learn from here, you have to make friends with the big guys to survive. It's the same lesson you learn in any prison, as you know from your time in Texas Penitentiary, David.
That's right.
You're either in... Sorry, you weren't there, but...
If you're watching now, all of my tattoos are covered up, so...
So you were in or out of the gang. And at the bottom of the pile were the roosters, as they were known, who were preyed on sexually by the other prisoners. Now, there's no sign at the time that Prigozhin was at the bottom, but we'll come back to that possibility later, because at the end of his life, this will be raised as a issue.
If that's not enough reason to go and join the declassified club, so you get early access to all of these episodes. I can't help you. No, go to therestisclassified.com and sign up.
Because that's going to come back, that bit of the story. But he learns to play by the system and he shows he's got what it takes to survive. He gets a tattoo on his back of a woman. And now this is made with a makeshift needle with the ink made from rubber, soot, and urine. Again, not part of my experience.
The back infection must have been tremendous. What was the tattoo of?
Of a woman.
Just a woman.
Yeah. Hopefully not the one he robbed. But he asked for a transfer to a timber logging colony, because of course these are all labor camps, you work. And here, it's interesting, he starts his own kind of business in which he gets other inmates to carve wood, which then can be sold to people outside the camp. So I guess what you see there is the combination of entrepreneurial, ambitious nature, coupled with violence, brutality, and an ability to survive. That is his personality there, in those early days. It's set, I think.
It reminds me of Pablo Escobar, another friend of the pod, you know, who had a kind of middle-class upbringing, but very early on demonstrated absolutely no interest in following any of the normal paths that would lead from that, and who kind of tilts into crime early, gets involved in these gangs, has his own sort of personal capacity for violence. He's not just at arm's length. It's very similar.
It's very similar. Smart enough to run things rather than
That's right. The Soviet Union's changing while he's in prison.
Yeah, exactly. So he's in prison in this period in the 80s. 85, Gorbachev comes to power. Younger generation of leaders wants to open up the Soviet Union. There's going to be political and economic reforms, new private enterprise, new freedoms, opportunities for the ambitious. Eventually, of course, as we know, that's going to spiral out of control. And Prigozhin gets released in 1990. So that's effectively the last year of the Soviet Union before it's going to collapse. And there's going to be a coup in 1991 to try and halt the changes. But effectively, you've got the end of the Soviet Empire, the end of Russia's control through the Soviet Union of places like Ukraine and the Baltic states. And Russia, as it hits the 90s, enters this wild decade. Economic collapse, massive social change, a kind of Wild West mafia capitalism in which, business deals are done with threats of violence to accompany them, everyone trying to get rich as fast as they can and get rich so they have enough power to stop them getting killed by a rival. It's kind of brutal, violent world.
Maybe it's less the case now, but when I was in school and I was learning about this era in Russia, there was a tendency to view it through the lens of this kind of attempted and ultimately failed experiment with liberal democracy. To some degree, that's true, but I think it's better or more accurate to see this as a bunch of people who were living essentially in a failed state, a government and a society, an empire in many ways that had collapsed.
Yeah,
and the violence, it's interesting talking to former agency officers who served in Leningrad and then St. Petersburg in the 90s. They would talk about regularly hearing gunshots, explosions. It's a sense of a place that had kind of come apart at the seams, and that was very lawless.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that kind of for a criminal entrepreneur,
yeah,
like exactly. Yevgeny Prigozhin, there's a lot of opportunity.
Exactly. So everyone is trying to get rich. Everyone needs protection from someone more powerful to avoid being at the bottom of the pile. In some ways, I think, you know, all of this, as you said, is suited to Prigozhin, who, you know, understands violence and business. In some ways, the outside world is now becoming like the world of the Russian or the Soviet prisons.
The prisons.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of mirroring some of that power structures in which having protection is actually, you know, translating into the business world of Russia. So he got this feel for it. So he's going to drop out of college. He's going to marry Lyubov in 1991, works at a car dealership, but his side hustle, and I love this, is running kiosks in Leningrad selling hot dogs. Now, this is where it kind of, you know, some of his reputation as a hot dog salesman comes from. Sausages have been around for a while in Russia,
yes.
Soviet Union, but the key was
No bun. No mustard.
No mustard. No ketchup. So you do that and suddenly you take the old sausage, add those things, and you have something kind of cool and Western and new. Which in the 1990s we're going to do very well.
It's the genes of the culinary world. Isn't
it is.
It? The hot dog. Yes.
That's our first food reference. He says he mixes the mustard in his kitchen and his mother, Violetta, helps count cash. She kind of plays
his wife isn't helping.
No, but his mother kind of is there actually all through his career. It's interesting in the kind of background. She's a kind of interesting figure. But he's making money pretty quickly. And he says he's having to pay $100 per kiosk per month protection money to the gangs. So you get a sense already that he's getting to know the gangs and understanding how to navigate that world.
This is maybe perhaps my only piece of knowledge that I'll drop on Russian criminality. But yeah. I believe the Russian word, which I will horribly mispronounce, for protection is krisha.
Yeah, a roof.
Roof.
Yeah.
An overhang, something over top
over
of
over your head. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, so he's paying for krisha.
And here in St. Petersburg, it's interesting. We were talking to an exiled Russian the other day who was saying, you know, Moscow, you have a central authority, you have the Kremlin, you have power. But St. Petersburg, you know, what had been Leningrad, is a little bit wilder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actually the thugs, the spooks, the businessmen have slightly freer rein and they're all kind of mixing together in this world as well, all using each other for kind of money, protection, muscle. Everyone's on the take. So Prigozhin is starting to move with more senior gangsters. They can see he's got good skills. You know, they can see his ambition. So he moves on from hot dogs. He manages some grocery stores and then casinos, classic kind of gangster thing, which, of course, the casinos are closely tied to the banks and to the gangs. Then comes the kind of the beginnings of the move into the world of restaurateuring. 1995, he's running a place called The Wine Club, a bar. He's got an English manager called Tony, which I guess makes him look classy, although it does occasionally feature strippers as well, so it's not that classy.
Could be classy.
It could be classy. And then comes the big break, because he opens a restaurant called the Old Customs House. It's a fancy old 19th century building on the riverfront near the Winter Palace. Tony, the English manager, comes along, French chef.
Where does the capital come from for this? Is it the hot dog money?
Or what? I think
is he just kind of slowly working his way
he's
up?
He's got some business partners as well who are basically gangsters.
Okay.
And at that point, they're in it together. And he'll eventually kind of ease them out. And it's interesting because Prigozhin can be charming, but also violent. He supposedly assaulted a chef after a complaint from a customer about the quality of the food. The chef was taken to the cellar and pummeled to the point of being hospitalized for 2 months. It's like not quite Gordon Ramsay shouting at you, but
no,
it's a lot worse.
It's not merely verbal abuse.
No,
yes, indeed.
It's a lot worse. So yeah. He's got a mix of charm and violence. Place will serve foreign food, that's the key, because, you know, the elite want the foreign food. French foie gras, oysters from Brittany, starting to be the same, you know, place where the new elite are kind of moving. World of mobsters and bodyguards, city officials, spooks. I don't know, Chicago, you know, it feels like Vegas.
Chicago in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah,
or
Vegas in the 50s. I don't know, something like that. It's got a feel of that, hasn't it?
It does. It's sort of borderline lawless and yet real collaboration in some cases between the authorities and the criminals. I think that to me is one of the hardest things to understand.
Yeah.
About, I mean, Russia in that period and Russia today is this very strange kind of marriage.
Yeah.
Between the security services, then the KGB, FSB, and these guys like Prigozhin who have lived for so much of their life sort of outside of the law, you know, but they're all
on the make.
On the make.
And they all kind of need each other. I guess that's the point. So, you know, this is his first restaurant. According to Candice Rondeau's book, Putin's Sledgehammer, among the guests at this place are Suzy Quatro and the Pet Shop Boys. I don't know if those are references which mean a lot to you.
But I know the Pet Shop Boys because my dad is a big Pet Shop Boys fan.
Okay, very good.
And I listened to that extensively as a child. Okay. As a result.
Well, there you go. Well, Suzy Quatro. No. But if the Pet Shop Boys listen, then let us know if you ever visited one of Prigozhin's restaurant. But about that time, it's thought Putin is kind of moving in these circles. So in some ways, Putin and Prigozhin, I think, are kind of similar because they are two people who've grown up on the wrong side of the street, you know. Mm-hmm. And Putin has come from quite a poor background in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. And he grew up in a kind of crowded apartment blocks. And Yulia Yoffe, the journalist, you know, talks a bit about this, about the world of the courtyard, the vor, which is where, you know, the courtyard of these apartment blocks, as a boy, Putin would have to show he could survive against the bullies and the thugs. And he's a small guy, Putin.
Yeah.
And so his way of surviving was to show he was capable of more violence than anyone else.
It's essentially, I mean, it's not quite this, but it's not dissimilar to the dynamics of the prison camp.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's the same kind of dynamics, which is you've got to show strength. You never show weakness. You're loyal to your friends. Anyone who bullies you, you hit them back harder. That's the kind of teenage world Putin grew up in, in Leningrad, St. Petersburg. So you can already see he's projecting the tough guy thing. You know, it's why he learns martial arts, because he knows, because he's small, he's got to survive. That's what he's come from as well. And that's also why Putin is going to be quite good at prospering in this new world of rough, tough, violent, kind of thuggish capitalism security services of Russia in the 90s. You know, he's got the right skills, just like Prigozhin, I think.
It's fascinating when you look at the demographics in the Soviet Union in the 50s, how many of the men were dead.
Yeah.
And how the Soviet state around the time that, you know, guys like Putin and Prigozhin are being brought up has essentially tried to engineer a baby boom to resurrect the population without any dads around.
Yeah.
So you have this, I mean, not to get all touchy-feely on you, Gordon, but it's like it's a period in time where there aren't a lot of dads around. And so you have, you know, whether it's these prison camps or whether it's these court, you know, the vor, these courtyards. I mean, it's a pretty unsupervised time for young Russian men. And I guess maybe there, Gordon, having set up the young entrepreneurial criminal, sort of brutal.
Yeah.
Yevgeny Prigozhin. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll see how he gets enmeshed into the world of Vladimir Putin.
See you after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Atio, the CRM for the AI era.
Now, David, people think that spycraft is just car chases and secret codes, but an awful lot of it is just idling around, waiting for the action.
It's a bit like starting your own business. You think it's going to be as easy as creating and selling a product, but the reality is business owners spend far too long trying to get their CRM to fit a system not built for them.
Atio's AI-driven CRM enables you to take control of your platform, to build something from the ground up that fits your needs.
James Bond had Q's X-ray shades, an explosive watch, and a pen grenade. Business owners have Atio's real-time customer insights and platform that grows with them. All tools relevant for your mission to build a company from the ground up.
Atio even has something called agent collaboration.
Yes, but in this case, that means giving people the ability to let AI work seamlessly in the background for them.
Try Atio for free at atio.com/trick.
Well, welcome back. Yevgeny Prigozhin is rising through the ranks of illicit, but also increasingly official St. Petersburg society, and he is going to become Putin's chef.
Yeah, that's what he gets known as. But it's interesting, trying to work out exactly when they met is a little bit murky. Both of them, I think, hid it a bit. But Putin is going to turn up perhaps at Prigozhin's first big restaurant, the old customs house. They might have also had some contact because Putin at one point sits on the gambling board. So Putin, we should say, has been a KGB officer. But then around the time of the end of the Soviet Union, he moves into city government as an advisor to the mayor of St. Petersburg. And so it's at that point that him and Prigozhin are gonna meet in this kind of murky milieu of, you know, kind of spies, crooks, officials. You know, maybe, as I said, because of the casinos that Prigozhin is running and Putin's on the gambling board, the extent to which Putin himself is involved in criminality is long been questioned about that period in the 1990s. There's a lot of interesting, slightly murky connections and deals, but it's fair to say that those who knew about it are largely dead or are close to Putin, and people who've
largely
looked into
dead.
It,
what are you implying?
they've met strange ends. Yeah. So, but they're going to get to know each other, Prigozhin and Putin. I think one thing to say is, though, it's very much Prigozhin is more like staff. The phrase Putin's chef, you know, which we'll come to, is kind of true. He's someone who's useful, who's staff, who works, if you like, downstairs, working for the boss. He's not, you know, on the same level in some ways as this. Of course, it's not quite true because he's not going to cook for Putin, but he's going to run the restaurant and run the catering, which I think, you know, suggests the power balance of the relationship. So Prigozhin's restaurant business grows, and this is important for the story because he's inspired by a trip to Paris and he sets up his new company, Concord Catering, and Concord will be the name, which is the kind of overarching business structure, which is going to run a lot of these things. They're going to buy a rusty old boat, remodel it, and turn it into a fancy floating restaurant called New Island. Now, this does really well, has its own truffle menu, David. Which I always like.
He's gone from hot dogs to a truffle themed menu.
With glove waiters. He's moving up. And it is all about ostentatious wealth. He's good about understanding what the rich, what the elite, what they want. He's got just that instinctive feel of what they want, and he knows how to offer it to them. Interestingly enough, the kind of waiters also are good at overhearing conversations and reporting back to him, but he's very discreet. And Putin, meanwhile, is on the rise. So they've encountered each other, but Putin is actually going to move from St. Petersburg to Moscow. And he's going to go into, you know, official positions in Moscow in the presidential administration. He's going to get picked to run the FSB, the security service. He's become prime minister in 1999. By 2000, you know, the end of the 90s, Putin is president of Russia. And he's going to bring a lot of his Leningrad, St. Petersburg friends with him to Moscow and keep them close throughout his life. And Putin's message, of course, is there's been this decade of Wild West, of humiliation, of economic collapse, of the West exploiting us, of just, you know, disaster and violence and crime. And Putin's message is, I will bring order, I will bring stability, I have the right skills. And, you know, you can see people responded to that after this period of chaos. Prigozhin, though, is still in Leningrad or St. Petersburg. He's not one of the inner circle of friends.
I guess if you move, you don't necessarily bring your caterer with you.
No, to the
other city, right?
Yeah. You bring your mates. You bring your close friends.
Yeah.
But Putin hasn't forgotten him. And so 2 months after he becomes president, Putin brings the Japanese prime minister to the New Island floating restaurant to show off. So he is a chef, but it's a kind of interesting position because one thing, as we get to the kind of way in which being a chef to a leader is important, is that you have to also be trusted to be a chef, because you've got to be trusted you're not poisoning the food. You know, which in medieval times, the chef was a kind of trusted position. Mm-hmm. And actually, Putin's own grandfather, weirdly, had been a chef to Lenin and Stalin. So I also wonder if Putin's got kind of admiration for chefs or a kind of respect for them. So he's kind of decided Prigozhin is his trusted chef. You know, not chef as in cook, but, you know, caterer. Person to do it.
Supplier.
Yeah, exactly.
Of food and food experiences.
And Putin wants to show off to all these kind of foreign leaders who he's bringing to Russia. Actually, Russia isn't what you thought it was, this kind of collapsing country. You know, we're capable of having fancy restaurants. So next year, Prigozhin is serving wine to President Chirac of France, whom Putin has brought as a guest. And Prigozhin will claim in a resume, which of course might be boasted, that he caters to 70 leaders of countries, including Prince Charles, now the king here, Tony Blair, Berlusconi of Italy, the then king of Saudi Arabia.
Why is he writing a resume?
It gets hacked at some point. It's a little bit murky. It's like
this is how you know he's not actually one of Putin's friends.
Yeah.
If you're having to draft a resume in the Russian system, you are not
in the inner circle.
Right.
Yeah. One person we do know for sure that he does really serve is President George W. Bush, because there's a couple of pictures of him being served by Prigozhin at the table. One on May 25th, 2002. The menu. I think this is important because now we get to our rest is food bit.
That's right.
The menu was...
This is our audition.
Yeah, exactly. He's looking to be sponsored by,
that's right.
by some fancy restaurant. the menu was duck liver pate and gingerbread. I don't know what I think about that. I don't know. Served with prunes and aged pork caramel. Don't know. It's not coming, I think. Black caviar on ice, fried fillet of beef with black truffles, accompanied by fresh morels and baby carrots, boiled in a rowan broth, and raspberry milfoy for dessert. Excuse me. I can't even read these words
because your French pronunciations are notoriously,
notoriously
uneven.
I wouldn't make a good kind of, you know, maitre d' at the Rest is Classified restaurants.
You were not selling our rest is food pitch very well, Jordan. So just
But what I love is you can see in the picture, Prigozhin is there kind of behind Putin and Bush. He's kind of, you know, he's there making sure everything goes well. He is the kind of maitre d' of the thing.
Yeah.
Putin then celebrates his birthday at the New Island restaurant 2003.
And we should say, follow us on Instagram to see that photo, because yeah. we've got some great photos posting that to the feed.
On the social media feed. Bush gets served again in 2006 when all the leaders are there at a G8 summit. It's not at the restaurant, but Prigozhin's doing the catering. This time, Prigozhin wears a silver tie. At the menu this time, should we go through it?
We should.
Astrakhan?
Astrakhan tomatoes?
Right. Yeah. Do you know what those are?
No. No. Tomatoes from Astrakhan, I guess.
Write in and tell us if you know. In balsamic vinegar. Crayfish with gooseberry marmalade. I don't know what I feel about that.
You know what this reminds me of?
Yeah.
Have you listened to the Rest is History episode on medieval cooking?
Yeah.
Where people are eating, like, you know, it's like eels,
yeah,
you know.
And you're like, why would you do that? It's not luxury.
Like, eels, like, stuffed with cow liver, you know, and like, you know, duck hearts or something like that. And this
it's
is
like
combining some exotic and strange animals with weird flavors and sauces.
Fried smelt with turnips and baby zucchini. What's smelt? I don't even know what smelt is. But I like this one fact. President Bush ordered a steak.
It's like, he didn't want the, he saw the crayfish floating in the gooseberry marmalade and he decided like, against steak. But Prigozhin's doing well, right? I mean, he's now, I guess as all of these ridiculous menus suggest, when Putin is entertaining really important world leaders, he goes to Prigozhin to provide the service of the catering and the food.
Exactly. So Prigozhin isn't one of the kind of big oligarchs. He's not like a kind of billionaire who's, you know, got lots of power in the 90s. He's kind of a new breed of people who are becoming rich under Putin and thanks to Putin and owe their loyalty to him. But he's not quite in the kind of category of the kind of either the big billionaires or millionaires or Putin's close pals like Sergei Shoigu, you know, who is one of his, you know, Putin's old judo partners. So, you know, he's a pal, but Shoigu will become Prigozhin's arch nemesis eventually. There's also other things. He tries something called Blini and McDonald's. So Blini's are, you know, kind of little pancakes. And it's Blini Donald's, which is a kind of like version of McDonald's, I guess.
Do we have any of the menu, like, do we know what the menu was?
No,
the menu's been wiped from the internet
because I think that business collapses. He also weirdly writes a kid's book in 2004 because he's a
Renaissance man.
He's going legit. Supposedly with his son, because he's now got a son Pavel and a daughter Polina, and it's the tale of a little boy and a sister who live with their family inside a chandelier. The boy falls from the ceiling into the world of normal human-sized beings and tries to get home. And a boy in this world of big people helps them out. Anyway, it's self-published. So self-published. 2,000 copies given away.
He was able to get contracts from the Russian state for food services, but he was not able to get a book published.
Yeah. Okay. But the business empire is growing. He gets rid of some of his kind of dodgier gangland partners. He opens restaurants in Moscow again, where he can kind of ingratiate himself with the new elite. Now, the point is he's going to use his friendships to get big government contracts. So he's now moving from restaurants to catering supply, and including also, you know, things like construction and real estate. But the crucial thing is he gets a contract for food for schools. Putin himself will open one of the factories doing the supply. I don't think the kids got the truffles and the caviar. I think this was a slightly lower level of catering. And actually, there's lots of reports in later years about the kids, you know, end up with vomiting bugs and dysentery from a daycare.
The quality
school
control was lax relative to the state dinners he was serving.
So he's getting, particularly gets to know a guy called Dmitry Bulgakov, who's in charge of logistics for the Ministry of Defense. You can see how he's moving in these circles. And that gets him a crucial contract for the military, worth about £500 million, $750 million, to supply food for the Russian army. Now, that is a big
deal. That's contract. A big deal.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's moving into making big money now, which again is just this entrepreneurial guy. May 2008, his company Concord Catering wins the contract to feed guests at Dmitry Medvedev's presidential inauguration. So important part of the story. Putin's been in power as president, but 2008, he decides he's going to step back to being prime minister, and his kind of protege at that time, Medvedev, is going to kind of hand over. But the problem is Medvedev doesn't do what Putin wants. You know, Putin's going to feel dissatisfied, and Putin is going to decide he needs to come back as president. You know, he's tried stepping back, doesn't like it. But that
shocking.
But that doesn't go well with those who thought Russia was on the path to a more liberal, you know, Western democratic system. And so when Putin says he's coming back, there's actually street protests, particularly in the big cities, particularly claims of rigged elections. This is all kind of December 2011. And Putin hates these protests. He comes to see them as being organized by those sneaky folks at the CIA, you know, all part of a plot by Western intelligence to bring about regime change in Russia. Strangely, people linked to Prigozhin are doing some of the catering for the protesters. And this is a kind of weird detail, but it is interesting. Now, that's odd, unless you realize he might be using it to kind of spy on them and understand what's happening, which is
the nexus of catering and espionage exactly. That we've been searching for in this series. And we've just found it.
We just found it. So Putin hates these protests. He fears the West is trying to spread, you know, these color revolutions which have happened in neighboring countries to kind of bring down pro-Moscow governments. So he's getting more and more aggrieved. He wants to crack down on dissent at home, go after his critics as he returns to the presidency. He's famously called, you know, the internet a CIA project. So he views the internet and the West as driving and using social media and these things designed to kind of spread Western ideas, undermine the country. And so at this point, he's going to think, I've got to do something about that. You know, I need to fight back. And interestingly enough, he's going to end up turning to Prigozhin to do this.
Who does not, at first blush, seem like a natural sort of resource in this fight.
No. No. And that, I think, is one of the curiosities of this story, is that you're going to take someone who's been a criminal, a thug, a kind of restaurateur, a supply caterer, and who is yet going to be part of Putin's core political project, both within Russia and then extending even into the United States.
That sounds like a cliffhanger to me, Gordon.
It is, David.
And I think there, with the former hot dog vendor now on the cusp of finding himself at the center of Russian official disinformation campaigns, let's stop. And when we come back, we will see exactly how Yevgeny Prigozhin, I guess, ends up in the middle of a disputed American election.
Yeah. See you next time.
We'll see you next time.
But don't forget.
Oh.
Don't forget.
We almost forgot. We almost forgot. But you
join
should
the
Declass
Backup, because you do not have to wait. Because if you want to hear all six episodes, if you want to know how it ends, and it ends spectacularly, you can binge by joining the Rest is Classified Club, the Declassified Club at therestisclassified.com. Sign up there. But otherwise, we'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time.